This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the New Books Network. Today, I'm delighted to have Professor Matthew Rubery, who is the professor of modern literature at Queen Mary University of London. Matt is interested in modern literature, media, reading practices, and everything in between. His publications include The Novelty of Newspapers, Victorian Fiction After the Invention of the News, and The Untold Story of the Talking Book, which is about audiobooks, among many other publications. But today, we'll be talking about his latest publication, Reader's Block, A History of Reading Differences, published by Stanford University Press in 2022. We'll get to that in a second. But first of all, Matt, a very warm welcome to you on this podcast.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Matt, why don't we start with you telling us a bit about yourself and your academic interests, and how did you come to write this book?
Sure. So as you mentioned, I teach in an English department at Queen Mary University of London. And I started out a fairly conventional literary critic, writing about Victorian novels. But my interests have really sort of expanded since then, particularly into the area of disability. And I'm particularly interested in the relationship between reading and disability. And that started when I was working on a history of audiobooks and trying to figure out where recorded books first started and trace that history back to the first recorded books made for disabled veterans of the First World War who came back from the war, had lost their sight, and needed a way to be able to read by themselves. And it was while working on that history of audiobooks that I started thinking about my new project, particularly because I kept coming up against debates over what counts as real reading. So you probably know that audiobooks kind of have a controversial reputation for some people. They're often seen as sort of an easy way to read or even a form of cheating. So I'd often come across these accusations of audiobooks not being real reading. And it sort of got me thinking about, you know, where that line is between what counts as real reading and not real reading, because I just never had that same confidence as critics of audiobooks have that there is just a really firm line between what counts as reading and non-reading. I've always thought those boundaries were very fuzzy, and I was never really sure just where exactly they ended. So that started me thinking, even though I was working on recorded books at the time, that got me thinking about, you know, what are some other sort of edge cases that either don't count as real reading or are dismissed as non-reading. And it really just got me thinking about all the different ways in which we interact with books. So that brought up the idea of neurodiversity, which I think is a really big idea now, although it was less talked about when I started researching this topic. But this idea of neurodiversity is just simply that there's a tremendous amount of variation in people's brains, and that we should think about those cognitive differences or the cognitive variations as differences rather than as deficits or as pathologies. And that sort of motivated me to then take all these edge cases that I'd found over the years, put them together into a history of reading differences. So the book I've written is basically a neurodivergent history of reading, bringing all these different edge cases together. And I deliberately use that phrase reading differences rather than reading disabilities, which might be more familiar to some of your audience, because I want to move away from a framework that emphasizes deficits and difficulties over potential strengths. It might be easiest for me to just give you one of my favorite examples of neurodivergent reading. And that's a savant named Kim Peek. Kim Peek could read two pages at the same time. He could read one page with his left eye, the other page with his right eye. It didn't matter whether those pages were sideways, upside down, or reflected in a mirror. And no matter what way those pages were oriented, he was one of the world's fastest readers. He could read incredibly long 600 or 700 page novels in under 90 minutes. He didn't just read them, he remembered them. I mean, it was really something closer to a scanner. So he could sort of look at these two pages and file them away in his memory and remember them nearly verbatim years later. So Kim Peek's nickname was the computer for this reason. So in some ways, you know, this is an example of incredible strengths and talents. But at the same time, Kim Peek, he needed support showering, dressing, and brushing his teeth every day. If he didn't have that, he wouldn't be able to read at all.
I'm glad that you brought up Kim Peek. We'll come to him in a second. But just before that, what I really found interesting was the concept of the unideal reader that you propose, because, you know, I remember reading Harold Bloom and How to Read and Why, and it seemed that reading was this exalted activity, which pretty much everybody does the same way. And the only problem was that we were not doing it enough, or we were not doing it at all. And just, you know, taking out books and reading them would solve all of that. But what you very convincingly argue is how, you know, unnatural an activity reading is, because I think you argue that we are not coded to read, maybe coded to speak, but not to read. And it is in these unideal cases, in the cases of these unideal readers, that we find these issues of neurodivergence that many readers kind of exhibit. So if you could talk us through who an unideal reader is and what a reader's block is.
I like your example of Harold Bloom's exalted reading. I want us to preserve that, but at the same time, it's just a very narrow range of all the different reading styles out there. And I kind of want to steer our attention towards some of those as well and bring them into the conversation. As you mentioned, it's important to state at the outset that there is nothing natural about reading. It's very different from speech, which is something we are hardwired to do, whereas reading is something that we have learned to do thanks to the brain's plasticity. It's an acquired skill through evolution over thousands of years. And that's one of the reasons I think it's such a complex activity. There's lots of variations to the way people do it, and there's no universal design for doing it. I know most people don't think that much about what is happening when they're reading. It's just something, an activity that most people do without thinking. But once you start thinking about it and realize how complicated it is and how many things can go wrong at every stage of the reading process, it's not surprising that some people struggle to learn to do it. I think what's surprising is that anyone can do it at all. So to come back to the idea of the ideal reader, so this is a term used by literary theorists who use the figure of the ideal reader as an idealized figure that's basically meant to represent everyone. And it's importantly a disembodied figure. So it's not someone who's going to be affected by sociological factors like class or gender or race. It's just sort of a disembodied mind engaging with the text. But a lot of historians of reading over the last couple decades have done really interesting work showing how sociological factors such as class, gender, race, nationality, things like that, make a huge difference to the way people read. So I really admire a lot of that work, but even in that body of scholarship, those critics are still dealing with cultural differences rather than cognitive differences among readers. And a lot of those studies still assume that the act of reading is kind of happening identically in people's minds from one reader to the next. So I'd like to sort of push back on the idea by getting us to think about the unideal reader. So someone whose cognitive differences make reading difficult or in some cases impossible altogether. So get us to think about all the variations in the ways people read. Think about reading as a spectrum of activities that vary from one person to the next. And, you know, this might just be subtle differences. And I do really enjoy talking to people about the different mental imagery we have. I mean, some people seem to see nothing at all in their minds while they read, while they're reading, whereas other people seem to have, you know, incredibly vivid films playing out in their mind. Whereas people who are affected by various cognitive conditions, something that will be well known like dyslexia or depression, that can make a huge difference on the way people read. And I think bringing those conditions into conversations will actually just give us a much richer understanding of what's happening when we're engaging with text.
One of the very self-evident sort of act that we do that we are not even aware of is decode letters and symbols while reading. And for dyslexic readers, that is precisely, that becomes precisely one of the problems that they face, as you talk about in the book. And by talking about dyslexic memoirs, you sort of indicate that, you know, decoding shapes and letters is a rather overlooked aspect of reading. So what do the experiences of dyslexic readers tell us about the very act of reading?
Whenever I'm talking about dyslexia now, a quote from the philosopher Gillian Rose comes to mind. And she grew up, despite being an extraordinary philosopher as an adult, she really struggled with reading and her dyslexia when she was growing up. But she says reading was never just reading when you grow up with dyslexia. And I've always found that really useful. And that definitely comes out in dyslexia memoirs, which, you know, it's just a curious genre in itself, because most of these memoirs are written at a time when there's very little tolerance for finding reading challenging. There's a huge stigma towards anyone who wasn't able to read. And, you know, lots of people suffered tremendously during their school years, either being bullied or teased by their peers, once it stood out that they struggled to read. So it's an interesting memoir because you would think the last thing someone who grew up being bullied about finding reading difficult would want to do is to then go, you know, write about the experience and deal with the very letters that caused them so much pain and anguish growing up. But in a way that makes sense too, because they really want to address this issue head on and kind of speak back to their critics through the very medium that they were accused of not being able to be competent at. Something that stands out to me in these memoirs, though, is that they really spend a lot of time scrutinizing what happens during the reading process itself. I mentioned a moment ago that, I mean, most people, when they're reading, they don't really think too much about what's happening inside their brain. Kind of like when we drive a car, you know, you don't really need to know what's happening under the hood to be able to get from point A to point B. But it's a bit like that with reading. If you're a neurotypical reader and reading kind of happens automatically and smoothly, if you're neurodivergent, you're probably intensely aware of what's happening or what's not happening while you're reading. So a lot of these memoirs do a fantastic job of drawing attention to perceptual distortions that individual readers see. And this might be things like, you know, the wrong letters, letters or words moving around on the page, mixed up sentences. Some dyslexic memoirs sort of talk about words flying off the page. One author who has a really great sense of humor describes the page looking like a bowl of alphabet soup. But I think what these memoirs do is they really get us to think about the crucial role played by decoding in the reading process. And by that, I just mean the act of looking at graphic symbols on the page and converting them back into speech. And that usually that coupled with comprehension, converting those symbols into meaning, those are kind of the big parts of reading. But people with dyslexia often get hung up on that decoding process. And that to me is worth thinking about because a lot of activity happens before we get to the stage of interpretation. Literary critics tend to jump right to that stage of interpretation and start debating alternative ways of thinking about the passage. But I think dyslexic readers make us think about the fact that people aren't necessarily dealing with the identical passages in the first place. And you know, often these memoirs bring this out in very painful, traumatized ways, but often with a sense of humor as well. And one of my favorite dyslexia memoirs is by a woman named Eileen Simpson. And she was writing decades ago. But she was just a tremendous, stylish writer of her own. She was married to a poet. I think she really thought a lot about the way she presented language as well as the challenges she had with it. She writes about reading the novel Little Women. And Little Women is just one of those novels. So many people I know just absolutely adore this novel. And, you know, a lot of people talk about how it changed their life and made them want to become readers or writers. Well, Simpson, as a dyslexic reader, has a very different experience with that text. She found it confusing. She couldn't really tell the characters apart. She never knew who was speaking. They all seemed the same to her. She thought the book was way too long. She ended up skipping almost everything in the narrative while she was reading it, except for the dialogue bits. And that meant that she missed the novel's very famous death scene. So she couldn't even understand why everyone got so worked up about this novel. But I like that idea too, of thinking about the way her experience of dyslexia and her encounter at the decoding phase, you know, kind of what she came into contact with in the first place, affected her understanding of the novel. And that really set her reading experience apart from neurotypical readers.
Yeah. And I think what you termed as the anti-bibliomemoir really kind of summed it up, this feeling of, you know, reading not really being as pleasurable as it is made out to be in the experiences of these people. But if you have a dyslexia on like kind of a spectrum, then on the kind of, I think, the opposite side, you have a very intense sort of engagement with decoding and reading, but not so much for comprehension, which you call as hyperlexia. And this is the example of what is called as hyperlexia. And this is the example of Kim Peek that you were citing earlier. So could you tell us a bit about what hyperlexia is and how are hyperlexic or autistic readers, or why are they so concerned with the surface of text? And would it be right to call their reading just superficial reading? Because that is what most of the times they're you know, kind of blamed for doing, that what they're doing is really engaging with the surface of the texts, the letters, the symbols, but not really getting into the comprehension bit of it.
Yeah. So I'm assuming your audience will know a bit about autism spectrum condition, but just to make sure, so that's a group of neurodevelopmental differences that affect the way the brain processes information and can sort of take lots of forms. The one I'm obviously interested in most is the way autism can affect aspects of behavior, including reading. So hyperlexia is usually, not always, but usually associated with people on the autism spectrum. And the easiest way of thinking about it is just as a precocious ability to read at a very young age without necessarily understanding what's being read. So some children start reading, you know, without any help. I mean, most people find reading really difficult. It takes them a long time to learn. They need a lot of teaching and a lot of patience. And that has to happen with outside help. Whereas a lot of people with hyperlexia just learn to read on their own and often can't explain how they do it at these young ages. Some of these people, though, even though they could read, let's say, an entire book quite fluently, or even memorize an entire book in some cases, don't necessarily know what any of those words mean, even though they can decode them properly. So I think we can sort of take this over to the question you've raised about different autistic styles of reading. And the one that sort of really captured my attention was thinking about the ways that sort of just reading without the goal of interpretation being in mind, staying on the surface, it kind of challenges the way we usually think about reading as an interpretive activity. So I use the phrase surface reading. And this, you know, this is a style of reading associated with autistic readers who are often preoccupied with aspects of books that tend not to get that much attention from other readers. I'm thinking here of aspects of the book's surfaces, like its cover, its binding, the type of paper, the ink used, or typefaces. To give you an example, I came across in one memoir the case of a young woman who used to shiver with delight when she'd encounter a hyphen on a page. Moments like that just sort of drew my attention to how some people have a very strong reaction that, you know, I'm guessing other neurotypical readers might like hyphens, but probably not have that strong a reaction to them. So just examples like that made me think about hyphens in an entirely new light. I would use that phrase surface reading rather than superficial reading, though, only because superficial kind of has negative connotations as, sort of staying on the surface because you are shallow or something like that. Surface reading seems, if not necessarily a deliberate choice, there are a deliberate strategy because a lot of autistic readers, find some type of satisfaction, whether that's aesthetic satisfaction or something else, in these features. So I'm thinking of readers who trace their fingers across the page because they like that slightly raised texture of the ink on the page. Again, sort of a level of micro detail that might go unnoticed by other readers. But in some cases, these are sensory pleasures that I think everyone will find familiar, even if autistic readers take them to a different degree. So some of the sort of aspects of the surface of text that autistic readers have called to my attention is sort of fundamental questions like, should you pay attention to the white space or the black space on a page? It never really occurred to me that some readers might sort of zoom in on the space between letters rather than the letters themselves, for instance. But autistic readers don't necessarily share the norms of other people and might find that drawing their attention rather than paying attention to the letters themselves. Or conversely, they might zero in on the shapes of the letters and find that meaning. So rather than thinking of letters as just sort of building blocks to words that you can then decode, they will just start thinking about these individual shapes. Other pleasures that come to mind is like, lots of people read for many hours of the day. Some autistic readers read, up to 12 hours a day. So where's that line between, reading too much, or is there such a thing? So things I hadn't really thought about are brought to my attention by this whole genre. I think sort of the point that came out to me, though, is that for most readers, the medium of communication, the words on the page, they're meant to kind of disappear as you lose yourself in the story, and the story plays out in an almost cinematic way in your mind. Whereas for autistic readers, that medium of communication doesn't necessarily disappear.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Today Healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways Healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
So would you say that this kind of intense attachment to the letters, the symbols themselves, this aestheticization, if you will, of the writing itself on the page, it kind of turns much mainstream reading and even literary criticism on its head, because there you have a very intense preoccupation with interpretation or comprehension, but not so much with actual words on the page, but the kind of experiences that these hyperlexic or even autistic readers have, kind of forces us to stop in our tracks and question what exactly are we doing when we read.
Yeah, I like the way you've just put it. It seems like lots of my neurotypical, excellent, very skilled reading friends, they do have their individual fixation. So I know lots of academics who really like to use particular fonts, like Garamond, for example, whereas others tend not to think about that factor much at all. So I think the difference is that they feel that they can kind of bracket those details and in order to talk about reading in a very generic way, as if we all do it in the same way and we can talk about it in a universal way. Whereas I think a lot of autistic readers say, no, I'm going to talk just about the font and not sort of shift to that common ground. So that is sometimes pathologized, and autistic readers are seen as not reading because they are thought to be incapable of having that sort of shared dialogue. But I think if we approach this from a different perspective about, you know, what exactly are they getting out of reading? Can we think about how our ideas of reading can be made to accommodate those different styles? What would that open up for us? Or what do their autistic people's reading interests help neurotypical readers to realize about their own reading habits? So I think it's really helpful to sort of view lots of different reading styles as provocations for self-reflection on one's own reading habits, and also where our assumptions about what counts as reading and what doesn't count sort of come from.
And one thing that can happen to neurotypical readers, a kind of lexia that you talk in the book, is alexia. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, which is the sudden loss of literacy, if you will. But you call it not illiteracy, but post-literacy, in a phase of being after literacy. What is alexia, and how does it happen? And in the memoirs that we that you discuss in the book, what are the experiences of these alexic readers, and how do they learn to cope with this sudden post-literacy environment that they are thrown into by, you know, an accident or something that they suffered, a brain injury or something like that?
Yeah, so I think it's a traumatic experience for a lot of people, because most people tend not to really think about the fact that literacy is something that can be lost. You know, most people think you acquire literacy in childhood and then you remain literate for the rest of your life. And, you know, for most people, that is the course of their lives. But as you mentioned, alexia is a condition where you lose the ability to read as a result of stroke, illness, head injury, something like that. Historically, it was known as word blindness, because these are people who can see the page, and it, you know, they can see the letters on the page that they used to be able to read, but the letters just don't have meaning for them anymore. So it's called word blindness because of that inability to recognize the meaning of these words. And sometimes the phrase acquired illiteracy is used. And I think that's more useful in terms of thinking about this state as a reversion to the state we're all born with, of not being able to read. I prefer the term post-literacy, though, because there's obviously a massive difference between experiencing the condition of non-reading as someone who's never done it or someone who's done it. And, you know, it's particularly, or it's traumatic in its own way, not being able to read, because or losing the ability to read, because you're intensely aware of precisely what it is that you've lost. And the sort of the drop in status, the stigma that you now have to put up with. A lot of people sort of cope with this condition by trying to pass as readers, pretending there's some people who love it. And, you know, it's an invisible disability, so you can, you know, get away with that for to a large extent. But I think that sort of that motivation taps into the feelings of shame that people are experiencing at no longer being able to read. So it's something that people find very different. Very difficult to cope with. I like to say that, you know, the most effective way to find out what reading means to people is to watch what happens when that ability is taken away from them. So, you know, it's usually something that's taken for granted, but suddenly people become profoundly aware of what reading means beyond just the physical ability of doing it. The value that reading has in modern societies. People become intensely aware of that once they're no longer able to do it, and start reflecting on things like, you know, how much of their identity is tied up with their ability to read. One thing that comes out in these memoirs, so just like the dyslexia memoirs we talked about a moment ago, you know, make us aware of certain components of reading that ordinary readers might take for granted. Alexia memoirs do something similar, in that they make us aware of the reading process as having multiple steps, multiple components. Any one of those steps of which can go wrong, you know, at any point. So again, they make us intensely aware of how complex the reading process is, and I mean, make me grateful that I can read it all, thinking how much has to happen at in our brains for things to go right. And one of the ways this is borne out is that a lot of alexic readers do find workarounds to continue being able to read. So they're no longer able to read visually the way they once did, but they're able to look at letters and sometimes trace letter shapes on their hands. And that act of manually tracing the shapes does enable them to read, you know, quite slowly, laboriously, but they can still do it. Or they can trace those letters, you know, using their toe, scratching on the ground, or even in one case I've come across, a patient with alexia was able to continue reading by tracing letter shapes on the roof of their mouth using their tongue. So that, you know, that sort of draws attention again to the different pathways there are to reading and gets us to think about reading as something much broader, much more variegated than just a visual activity as it's often thought of.
And is it possible for alexic readers to regain their literacy over time, or is it gone forever?
It depends. In most cases, it seems to me that people do not regain their, let's say, their speed, their ease, their fluency with reading. There's a huge range. I mean, some people do regain it. I think most people have to work quite hard at rehabilitating the reading. But even then, it's hard work. So again, it might be sort of going from kind of reading as an automatic, streamlined process to having to sort of work letter by letter through words. So it makes leisure reading very difficult then. They can sort of do functional reading, read, let's say, street signs and things like that. But it just would take too long to read a novel. It would not be relaxing in a way that a lot of leisure readers associate, you know, reading with pleasure. So it's quite rare. It is quite a massive change. And then some people never do regain the ability at all. Fortunately, I think there's much less of a stigma today. Lots of people seem to read less anyway, because we're not just dealing with post-literate readers, but some media theorists like Marshall McLuhan have said we're in a post-literate society where people don't really need to read anymore because we're switching towards a, you know, more multimedia visual based society. Or there's lots of adaptive technologies like text to sound screen readers that can make this information much more accessible. But at the same time, I think, you know, reading does have a special place in a lot of people's lives. So a lot of people are highly motivated to try to retain some degree of reading in their lives, you know, partly because it's a useful skill, but partly, as we spoke about a moment ago, it's an important component of their identities.
In the second half of your book, you move away from lexias to talk about some other conditions, which kind of hinge on the relationship between the body and the brain. And that becomes even more complicated and has to do with things on the page or around you that is not even there when you're doing the act of reading. And one of these is synesthesia, where you see different fonts or writing on a page in different colors. You come to associate certain letters with colors. And one of the most famous synesthetes, as you point out in the book, was Vladimir Nabokov, if I'm not wrong. So how does the experience of seeing these letters in different colors kind of change maybe your comprehension itself of how you perceive the book or what you make of it?
So I like to think of synesthesia as a super ability.
Unlike
a lot of the other conditions in my book, which are often thought of as disabilities. Yeah. In fact, I've got envy of a lot of the synesthetic readers I've spoken to, because some of them just seem to see this sort of, you know, vibrant rainbows in their minds while they're reading, whereas the majority of readers are just sort of seeing black letters against a white page. So Nabokov's a great example. So anyone who wants to see, a really brilliant aestheticized account of reading, I mean, go read his autobiography, Speak Memory, and his description of his apprehension of letters. So that's kind of the question that you raise that animates my entire chapter is, how does the experience of seeing letters and colors influence the reading process? I propose the phrase bibliographic double consciousness to think about the differences between, you know, this type of neurodivergent reader or someone who sees in this case, both the original page, so the page that most other readers are seeing, but at the same time, they see that page overlaid by an array of colors that other people will not see. And it's important to note that, you know, just like, you know, Nabokov described the letter A as having the tint of weathered wood, for example, no other synesthetic reader would have the same sort of color scheme that they see. Each synesthete will have a slightly different color scheme that they see when they see letters. And each synesthete will usually insist that their color scheme is the correct one. That's important to notice because, it's not like there's just one color scheme viewed by everyone. So synesthetes are having a completely different experience of the text than other readers. So that's kind of what I mean by double, is that there's both, they do see the same page as the rest of us and are kind of aware of the way neurotypical readers see the page, but they're also having kind of a private aesthetic experience at the same time. So going back to that question of how would seeing the alphabet in colors affect the experience of reading, what I have found by looking at lots of different examples is that, it can enhance the reading experience in some cases, or it can equally disrupt that experience and bring it to a halt altogether in some cases. So for instance, some people, some aesthetes fixate on individual words that are just particularly striking to them. So this might be a name, for instance, that's in a beautiful, ravishing color. And it would be tough for them to continue reading because they just want to look at that, that word or that particular combination of letters. So that's a way in which, neurodivergent reading can kind of become distracting and act as a form of reader's block because it sort of blocks the flow that most people experience with reading. But to give a very different example, there's also another variation of synesthesia called gustatory synesthesia. And so that's for readers who, when they're looking at letters, instead of seeing letters in colors, they experience tastes, like literal tastes in the back of their throat, on their tongue while they're reading. And that's great if you see a word that has the taste of chocolate cookies, for instance. I mean, you will have the taste of chocolate cookies in your mouth when you encounter that word, and you'll probably enjoy reading whatever text has those words. But you might also come across a word that is associated with the taste of vomit in your mouth. And then you are not going to read that text, no matter how interesting you might find it on an intellectual level. So that would be an example, again, of reader's block, of disrupting the experience of reading altogether.
And another disruption of the act of reading would be hallucination, of which one of the most famous examples is Samuel Taylor Coleridge when he was writing Kubla Khan. But as you point out, we are not really sure if he had that sort of hallucinatory experience, if he had that dream or not. But still, hallucination seems to have played, it seems to be kind of common in the act of reading, in the examples at least that you discuss, where it becomes difficult for readers to kind of separate fact from fiction. Could you elaborate on the aspect of hallucination while reading a bit?
Sure. I mean, Coleridge is a great example of, maybe hallucinations is a superability, because I would love to be able to hallucinate great poetry like Kubla Khan. I'm interested in that kind of overlap between, examples like Coleridge, where reading is not seen as pathological, even though we're not entirely sure whether it's a drug reverie, a form of dreaming or what. In any case, that's not seen as pathological or a disability. And reading itself seems to be almost a form of guided hallucination, a form of hallucination that we can kind of invite when we sit down with a book and start seeing mental imagery in our minds. In most cases, as you mentioned, readers are going to be able to tell the difference between the mental imagery they're seeing that's kind of stimulated by the words on the page versus reality. But that is not true for all readers. This is a theme in classic fiction, of course. So you might think of like Don Quixote or Madame Bovary, which are often warning readers about the dangers of confusing the world of books for the real world. But the point is, you're supposed to be able to make that distinction. Readers affected by, let's say, hallucinations at another level, let's say readers who are affected by psychosis, certainly paranoid schizophrenics often have trouble distinguishing between what they're reading and reality. So they might hear voices, for instance, or they might be paranoid that the passages on the page are actually coded messages being given to them that they are supposed to act on. So one example that I came across was of a young woman with schizophrenia who read Virginia Woolf's novel Orlando. She actually booked a train ticket to go to Orlando, Florida, because she thought that is what the novel was telling her to do. So that, I mean, that seems a type of interpretation that is unlike any interpretation that a neurotypical or an ordinary reader, I think, would get from that novel. And, you know, importantly, she didn't see that as like a choice. I mean, she thought that was a command. So that's example of the mental imagery, the hallucinations overtaking reality in a way that can cause real harm. But, you know, at the same time, I think this raises interesting questions about, you know, where that line is between paranoid reading of the sort that critics are known for, where, you know, you might see, I don't know, a Christian message or a Marxist message, a subversive message in the text that other people might not think is there. You know, where's the line between that and, let's say, these more consequential hallucinations that that other people are experiencing? But at any rate, it makes me think a lot about your perception itself as feeding into that process of interpretation in a way that sort of sets readers apart. So again, not every reader is having identical reading experience and then trying to interpret text in different ways. Some people are arriving at that stage with very different encounters with the text.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
And are there any specific things or events which seem to trigger these hallucinations, or do they seem to come of their own?
There is, let's say, a spectrum, like a lot of the conditions I'm talking about. So, you know, some people might have very mild responses to text, and then I think it's, people affected by mental illness, I think it will just gradually onset. Curiously, people have very different reactions. I mean, some people read as a way of, so some schizophrenics read as a way of suppressing voices. So one memoir I read describes reading Dickens novels because that holds the voices at bay while the person is reading. But as soon as they stop reading, you know, that internal monologue in their head from reading is replaced by outside voices that they hear in their head ordering them to kill themselves or commit other acts. So it is quite, a sort of charged, complicated relationship to books in that case. Whereas other people might have, you know, brain injuries of some sort that lead them to actually see words like hallucinated onto walls around them. They might see letters, sentences, things like that. And that's not something they have any control over. It is a neurological disorder. It is often a sign of other conditions affecting their brain. So quite serious, even though the act of just sort of, you know, seeing short fragments of text around the world doesn't seem that big a deal.
And in the last chapter, you turn to memory and the role that memory plays in reading by talking about the challenges that dementia brings to readers who are long experienced in the act of reading. And you say that dementia memoirs, they show us the phenomenon of de-reading. And so could you tell us a bit about what de-reading is and what are these challenges that readers with dementia face when they read?
Sure. Thanks for singling out that phrase. I mean, you know, most people when they get older, particularly some of my colleagues I know who've been reading all their lives, they start talking about the pleasure of rereading books in their twilight years. People with dementia, though, of course, are going through a process of what I call de-reading, meaning they are gradually losing the ability to read. So most people know that memory loss associated with dementia makes it difficult to concentrate on books or remember what's in them. Even if people with dementia are able to still read, they are often not reading in the same way they used to because they can't remember the entire sequence of events that you need to get closure in a novel, to sort of get to the climax at the end and make retrospective sense of everything that's happened before that. So I don't think that will be surprising to anyone that dementia makes reading difficult. But I am guessing that a lot of those people who do understand the harmful effects of dementia on reading might not be as aware that a lot of people with dementia continue to find reading pleasurable long after those people have stopped being able to read books in the conventional sense of the term. So people keep reading, even though they are reading in a very different way. Readers with dementia might enjoy just reading small chunks of text, even though they can't really fit it into a larger plot. Or they might enjoy pronouncing words whose meanings they once knew, but can no longer quite remember what those meanings are. They might just like reading captions of pictures in the book, or reading or looking at pictures themselves, because those pictures might evoke memories or reminiscences for them. These readers might trace shapes, so similar to the alexic readers we talked about, but that would kind of be the end of itself, just sort of enjoying the pleasure of interacting with the shapes of letters rather than having an expectation that those letters will mean something. Readers with dementia might start co-reading instead of reading individually. So they'll read along with a caregiver, and the caregiver will be able to give prompts or something when they get stuck. So the question I'm interested in when I'm reading dementia memoirs or talking to people with dementia about their interest in books is, why do people keep reading books long after they've stopped being able to understand them and aren't really reading for the plot, as literary critics would say? What I found by looking at all these different strategies of reading associated with dementia is that it got me, certainly, as someone without dementia, to start thinking about sort of the micro pleasures of reading that don't depend on our ability to sort of comprehend the entire text. Just the way individual words and phrases might stand out to us, or a sentence might sound pleasurable in our mind's eye, things like that. Sort of think about the small gestures involved with reading without the pressure for them to all add up to some grand total.
In the book, I think one of the things that struck me about your research was how much importance life writing plays here in this book, whether in the form of memoirs or in the form of autobiography and so on. And I'm guessing that since this book is one of the few books on neurodivergent ways of reading, you would have faced a lot of challenges, especially given that you'd have to consult medical literature and you'd have to unearth these memoirs, autobiographies. So if you could talk a bit about what it was like writing this book and researching for it. And,
sure. So I didn't realize when I started this research project.
What you dealt with those?
Sure. So I didn't realize when I started writing this book just how much life writing there was by people with cognitive differences over the last few decades. So there was a pleasant surprise. And in many ways, I think about my book as a history of neurodivergent reading kind of up to the present day, where I think there's been a real explosion now that the internet's made it so easy for people to publish blogs or self-publish entire books and make them available to people. So I think a lot of life writing is now widely available that's been written by neurodivergent people, whereas this just was not the case several decades ago, where there were huge barriers to access to, making it possible for neurodivergent readers to tell their stories. So even though there are a lot of these books out there, I had to really spend a lot of time tracking these books down, because a lot of them are self-published. So not easily accessible through libraries and stuff. not widely available. So that took a lot of time. But the rewards are that you get to sort of step back, see a broad body of work, and make comparisons that you would not be able to do otherwise. In addition, it's really allowed me to let neurodivergent readers speak for themselves as much as possible, rather than kind of relying on me as their mediator or ambassador in some ways. So I really made an effort to do that. At the same time, these genres are very interesting because the conventions are so different for neurodivergent life writing than for neurotypical life writing. So, for instance, one book I read by a woman with a brain injury who could no longer read, it says right on the first page that the author hasn't read her own book, and she just wanted to warn the reader of that. That's just something that you would not encounter, I think, in another genre. And I'm hoping this book will bring us up to the modern day, and now people will start doing work on just the profusion of life writing that's out there and available. I sort of hope this starts a much bigger conversation.
I'm sure it will. One last question about the book that I wanted to ask you was, what do you see as reading today, especially given that now that we understand reading to be such a varied kind of activity, which changes from person to person, there are so many different kinds of readings. There are neurodivergent ways of reading, and especially now with the proliferation of many other sort of tools that neurodivergent users, readers can use, even neurotypical readers can use, whether it be audiobooks or videos and speech to text software and so on. What is the future of reading that you see, and what would you like it to be? And if there is a way to overcome reader's block, or is that a wrong way of thinking about reader's block in the first place?
So I, in some ways, I'm very encouraged that attitudes towards neurodiversity have changed so much over the last decade or two. Certainly at the university I teach at, we pay so much more attention to dyslexia and other forms of neurodiversity than we used to, and make accommodations or find ways to support students so they can kind of do their best work rather than just penalizing them for aspects of their dyslexia. So that's very encouraging. That I think there's much broader awareness of neurodiversity than there used to be. Yeah. What I hope my book does is challenge that widespread assumption that many people still have, that there is a standard way of reading and that any deviations from that standard way of reading are kind of not real reading, to go back to the start of our conversation. And even though most people think of reading as a relatively straightforward activity that most of us know how to do without thinking too much about once we learn to do it, a closer look at this term just shows how complex it is and how many different activities are covered by that umbrella term. That's something I want us to think about and be more aware of too. What I'm calling for in this book then is a more expansive, inclusive definition of reading that would accommodate all these diverse ways people interact with texts. So going beyond thinking about reading in kind of a very narrow way as decoding, comprehension followed by interpretation. Some acts of reading might involve just decoding, or some might involve sensory pleasures, things like that. And I'd like to bring those in to the conversation about reading, to think about what we can gain by expanding the concept to include lots of different ways of doing it. So if we think about reading in terms of a spectrum capable of accommodating the full range of behaviors that I've documented in this book, I think we have a lot to gain by doing so. And I think that's not just useful for neurodivergent readers who are often stigmatized or penalized for their way for reading in unconventional ways. I think it'll help everyone achieve a richer sense of what's happening in their minds when they're reading. So I just notice, I've started talking to my students more at the beginning of seminars and stuff about, what type of reader they are, what's happening while they read, how they engage with books at all sorts of levels. And just the range that comes out is astonishing. So again, just they might talk about their mental imagery in ways that would just vary radically from one student to the next. So I think this can really open up opportunities for talking about texts that we've been missing out on if we just think about reading as happening in one way.
That's a great thought, Matt. That reading is like, we should not think of it in terms of a unified ideal activity, but is varying from person to person. But we have already taken up a lot of your time. But if there's a book that you like to read and would recommend to our listeners that you really cherish and admire, or if you could tell us about any research projects that you are currently working on, that would be great.
Sure. In terms of research, I still think a lot about this relationship between reading and disability. I have spent a lot of time in my career working with adaptive technologies designed to help people with physical or cognitive disabilities be able to read by themselves. So for instance, recorded books, audiobooks, that's an example that was designed at the beginning of the 20th century. Lately, I've been working on a new technology known as projected books, and that most people have not heard of this. But projected books were designed after the Second World War, again, for soldiers who come back from the war and were hospitalized for injuries. They'd often lost use of their limbs and had to stay in hospital beds for months at a time recovering, and often had nothing to do, couldn't hold a book for themselves even. So were often quite bored. So projected books, it was quite a simple invention. It was just a vertical projector that displayed a microfilm image on the ceiling of a printed book. So people lying in bed could see a page of a book on the ceiling and read while they were laying in bed. And they could operate this projector using a little handheld remote control. They could press the buttons on it using their hands or their toes or their chin, whatever motion or functionality they still had. So I acquired one of these machines, and I've been working with charities like Blesma, who's a charity for disabled limbless veterans in the UK, I've been working with them to sort of do show and tells of this device, just to get people to think about alternative, unconventional ways of reading and show off how easy it is to read a book on the ceiling. So that's kind of what I'm doing now and will continue doing. And I encourage anyone in your audience who wants to talk about their idiosyncratic ways or unconventional ways of reading, I would love to hear them. So please share them with me. In terms of a book to recommend to people, one that stands out to me is Temple Grandin's autobiography. So Temple Grandin is one of the, if not the most famous autistic person in the world. She's a scientist who's written quite a few books on lots of topics, including books about her own experience as an autistic person. So the one I have in mind is titled Thinking in Pictures and Other Reports from My Life with Autism. It was published, I think it was 1995. It was one of the first books written by an autistic person rather than a book written by someone else about an autistic person. So rather than a book being written by doctors or parents about all the problems of being autistic, this was an autistic voice that really transformed the way lots of people thought about autism. So it's a great example of a well-known motto among those of us who work in the field of disability studies: nothing about us without us. So it's an autistic person sort of giving her insider's perspective of being autistic. And it really opened the door for so much subsequent life writing by people with autism and other conditions to sort of tell their stories and sort of speak back against lots of stereotypes that they put up with for much of their life. Why I think it's interesting for people now is because it's a fascinating description, a very self-aware description by Temple Grandin of the way her mind works. And the way her mind works differently from a lot of other people's. So she talks about the visual imagery in her head in great detail. And kind of what she was famous for was working on cattle farms and designing new ways to make those cattle farms safer and more humane for the animals there. And the way she was able to do this was by visualizing what these animals saw when they were kind of walking down ramps and stuff into tubs of water. So rather than just sort of looking at these ramps from the human perspective, she was looking at this from the animal's perspective. It's really extraordinary what a difference it made to take that sort of empathetic approach to the topic. So she really, her insights really transformed the conditions of livestock around the country. In terms of reading too, I mean, this is what drew my interest to, of course, is she describes her reading processes in equally fascinating ways. And she basically had a photographic memory. And there's a great example that's brought up really well in the film based on Temple Grandin's life, where a young Temple Grandin is in school. She's in French class, and she's asked, the whole class is asked by the teacher to read a passage from their textbook, and then they're going to get asked questions about it. And Temple just glances at the page and then looks away and starts doing something else. And the teacher comes over and says, why aren't you reading the passage like I asked? She says, I did read it. And the teacher, of course, thinks she's just being, insolent or disruptive. So he starts quizzing on it. It turns out, she had basically just glanced at the page, stored away basically a photographic snapshot of that page in her head so she could sort of access that at any time. So in a way, she was reading because she had, interacted with the book and could quote verbatim what was on that page. But in a way, she was also kind of deferring the act of reading till she actually needed to do it. So when she was called on by the teacher, then she could read it, from her head. So, a fascinating way in which, again, that seems a strength of neurodiversity in her case. She was a very high functioning autistic person who, is capable of all sorts of scientific discoveries and that. So not necessarily typical, but fascinating to just read a person's account of how they experience the world in their heads in very different ways from lots of other people. So I'd say that's a great place to start if you just want to think about different ways of interacting with the world mentally.
Thank you so much for that book recommendation. And thank you so much for the wonderful work that you're doing with charities and projected reading. And we really encourage our audience, our listeners, to reach out to you if they have any idiosyncratic ways of reading, unconventional ways of reading. And thank you once again for being here. I had a lovely time talking to you.
I really appreciate the chance to talk about my book. So thanks for the questions and discussion.